On This Week in Enterprise Tech, did your NAS get cryptlocked? Did Snowden actually hurt the United States? And oh yeah, it's the Black Hat 2014 preview. Twite on the set.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for This Week in Enterprise Tech is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Twit. This Week in Enterprise Tech, episode 102, recorded August 4th, 2014. Black Hat 2014 pre-show. This Week in Enterprise Tech is brought to you by Prosper. Prosper is a peer-to-peer lending marketplace that connects people who are looking to borrow money with those who have money to lend. Visit prosper.com/twit and receive a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Welcome to Twit, This Week in Enterprise Tech. It's the show dedicated to the enterprise professional, the IT pro, and the geek who just wants to know how the world is connected. I'm Father Robert Ballas here, your host and guide to all things in the enterprise. And of course, I'm joined by my regular all-star cast of characters, starting with the man to my left, but really is probably in Hawaii, Mr. Brian Chi, the director of the Advanced Network Computing Laboratory in Honolulu, Hawaii. But right now with a huge gargantuan face because it's so close to the camera. Brian, how are you?
I'm doing good. I'm actually starting to get used to the lack of humidity. But you tell me, we actually have a lot of humidity for this time of year in Vegas. It's kind of weird.
Right. And you're getting ready for DEF CON and Black Hat, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I'm sorry. No, we just had to do that. Also joining me is Mr. Curtis Franklin. He's the man who's actually not in my house at the moment. He's over on the right coast. Curtis, how are you today?
Oh, I'm doing just peachy, Padre. I am sitting here having spent much of the day preparing to head in your direction, leaving the friendly confines of the swamp to the place where all my skin is going to fall off.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sorry about that. That's just going to happen. Now, gentlemen, this is the week, the big week, the security week, the week in August where people burn their feet off in order to attend Black Hat and DEF CON here in Las Vegas, Nevada. So we're going to dedicate this show to some of the stories we think are going to be floating through the conference and some of the press releases that we've been receiving from the vendors. But before that, let's go ahead and get to the Enterprise Blitz. The first one is, of course, the most important story of the week, and that is that Facebook went down for 20 whole minutes and the world ended.
But from CNN Money, Google Glass wearers can now steal your password. Yet another reason to beware of glass holes. In this story, cyber forensics experts at the University of Massachusetts in Lowell have developed a way to steal passwords entered on a smartphone or tablet using video from Google's face-mounted gadget and other video-capturing devices. The thief can be nearly 10 feet away and doesn't even need to be able to read the screen. The security experts created software that maps the shadows from the fingerprints on a tablet or smartphone. The research will be presented this week at the Black Hat Security Conference at the Mandalay Bay Convention Center.
And in proof that you don't have to have advanced technology to steal an identity, we have General Cho's identity theft. Yes, restaurant chain P.F. Chang admitted that 33 of their locations had been hit by a vulnerability exploit that allowed criminals to steal credit card information in late 2013 and early 2014. In addition to the credit card numbers, victims might have had their names and the card expiration dates compromised, making them very vulnerable to credit and ID theft. P.F. Chang said that it has offered affected customers financial protection and free credit monitoring, but the latest breach is more evidence that the sodium level isn't all you need to watch when you're dining out in 2014.
Now, SDN has been touted as the next evolution of IT, yet a survey of 400 IT decision makers by Juniper Networks have found that almost half of them have no plans to adopt SDN. The stated reasons for the reluctance to join the software-defined network train include 35% of respondents who claim difficulty in integrating SDN into their existing networks, 34% who had security concerns, and more than 28% who worried about the lack of SDN skill set in-house. Of the 52.5 respondents who said they would implement SDN, however, 74% plan to deploy within the next year, while 30% said they would be using SDN within a month.
Well, the folks at IDIS The folks at IDIS Networks are looking at an affordable, comprehensive, and easy-to-use enterprise-grade intrusion detection and unified threat security system for your consumer firewall. Right now, those El Cheapo are like a hotel where you just open the door to your web server. But that's it. What IDIS is looking at doing is similar to adding a bouncer at your door that actually checks the IDs and makes sure they're not carrying a loaded gun in their bag or aren't infected with SARS. Look for IDIS Networks to launch the iGuardian on Kickstarter this Thursday at 10 a.m. Pacific and at DEF CON this week. See what it's about at www.itusnetworks.com/Kickstarter and see them in DEF CON booth number 38.
And what a great time for something like that, because ransomware gets easy. Yes, researchers have found a malware kit in Russia that boils advanced ransomware down to a simple batch file that a script kiddie can control with a command line script. The malware uses NewPG to encrypt a victim's data files. And this combination of open source encryption and easy to use scripts manages to take two very good things and turn them very bad. Welcome, everyone, to the 21st century.
And finally, the Identity Theft Resource Center, a group that tracks data breaches around the world, reports that they have identified 381 separate data breaches exposing 10.8 million records from January to June 2014. The largest names in these breaches include the Montana State Department of Public Health and Human Services, that's 1.3 million records, Butler University, which lost 163,000 records, and a yet uncounted number of records from AOL and, of course, P.F. Chang. Well, that's the enterprise blip. Let's go ahead and get into the enterprise bite. The first story that we need to chomp into is actually something that strikes a little bit close to home. It's more of a Soho story, but it's also got some serious enterprise ramifications. And that is Synology arrays, and all the owners who use Synology arrays are now under the threat of CryptoLocker hacks. That's right. CryptoLocker hacks have been around for about the last 5 or so years. We used to see them on poorly defended Windows boxes, but recently we're starting to see them migrate, evolve to attack Linux, Mac OS X, iOS, and Android devices. The attack is simple. You get remote entry into a device, and then you encrypt some of the files, and you ransom the encryption key to your victim. Normally that ransom is paid in either money orders or in bitcoins. Now, that threat has evolved once more to attack not just desktops and laptops and mobile devices, but it's targeting Synology's NAS boxes. Users of Synology network-attached storage devices can now be hacked directly on their NAS. What will happen is the attacker will encrypt part of the files that are on the NAS, and then you'll have to pay a ransom to get it back. Now, Brian, I'm not sure if you went ahead and downloaded the file from the Dropbox. But if you did, go ahead and write it here. You may have heard by now that this is a statement from the company that DSM is undergoing a crypt locker hack called SinoLocker as of yesterday. That's 8/3/2014. It's a Bitcoin mining hack that encrypts portions of the data on your array and ransoms the decryption key for 0.6 Bitcoins, which is about $350. So far, it looks like the matter is localized to non-updated versions of DSM, that's their operating system, 4.3, but we are actively working on and researching the issues to see if it affects DSM 5.0, that's their latest version as well. Now, in the interim, Synology is asking their users to basically be ultra paranoid. A, close all open ports to external access as soon as possible, and or, this is the big one, unplug your disk rack station from your router. They want you to update your DSM to the latest version, back up your data as soon as possible, and then they promise Synology will provide further information as soon as it is available. Now, Brian, let me throw this over to you first. This is kind of unprecedented when you have a device manufacturer who is going the distance of saying, we don't know yet how this affects the latest version of our operating system. The best thing you can do is to turn it off or completely disconnect it from the outside world.
Oh, what Synology is trying to do is say, you know, let's be really, really cautious. Your data is valuable to you, and as a result, it's also valuable to us. Let's go err on the side of caution and give our experts time to go and find out whether we really are vulnerable or not. But in the meantime, let's be safe.
Yeah, let's be safe. Now, Curtis, they're also saying that if your NAS has been infected, that they first do not want you to trust any email from unauthorized, non-genuine Synology email. They say that, you know, their email, of course, always includes the Synology.com email because the address, because they don't want people to make the situation worse. And they say to do a hard shutdown of your disk or rack station once you've disconnected it by going ahead and holding down the power button. This is kind of an unprecedented move. I mean, if your company is based on the secure storage of people's data, and you're now saying the only way to make it secure is to shut it down, that's not a good thing, right?
Well, I think that it is, of course, not a good thing. On the other hand, I think what we may be seeing here is an entirely appropriate response, saying, you know, we know that people depend on us. We want them to continue to depend on us. And the only way to make sure that can happen is to follow some fairly drastic measures. I think this is similar in some ways to what we've just seen in an entirely different realm up in Toledo, Ohio, where they encountered some small levels of some toxins in the water. So they told everyone not to drink it, but not to use it for bathing, not to use it for washing, not to use it for any purpose for 3 days. Was that a dramatic, drastic set of steps? Yes, but they wanted to act out of an abundance of caution. And I think that what we see here is that, DSM is doing the same thing, acting out of an abundance of caution. And most customers, I think, are going to appreciate that, even if they find it a bit of a pain to comply.
All right. We've got Yogi in the chat room who's actually asked a pretty decent question, which is, I don't get it. How can a NAS be infected with malware? I mean, when we think about a NAS, we think of it's a box, right? It's a box that connects to your drives and then it connects to your network so you can access your drives. Well, the thing is, NASs have become more and more sophisticated over the years. The consumer grade NAS that you used to buy that included one drive and then maybe got you really, really slow access to your data, those really aren't around anymore. Synology NASs and most NASs from other manufacturers run on some flavor of Linux. In this case, the flavor of Linux had a backdoor that allowed someone to remotely execute code. Now, the problem with that is we saw this a few months ago with the Synology Dogecoin hack. What had happened in that instance was someone gained access to a directory in Synology that they were able to put software and then execute that software to make the Synology NAS Doge mine for it. This is essentially the same thing. It's just the remote execution of a piece of software. The only difference is that it's happening on your NAS, which is responsible for your data. Chibert, I want to throw this to you one more time. You've already had a little bit of panic surrounding this because you've run some Synology boxes. This is difficult for those who run a lot of remote IT, right? Because the idea of doing a hard shutdown or disconnecting something from the network means you now need remote hands to go back and turn it on.
Yeah, well, in this case, one nice thing about the Synology is you can set the status of what the NAS does when it comes from a power outage. So when I get the all clear from the Synology folks, I'm actually just going to power cycle that socket on the power distribution unit in my data center. So I can still bring it back. And they also have Wake on LAN. So as long as I have a trusted machine on that network, I can SSH into that and issue a Wake on LAN command also.
Right. Let's just hope for the best. Hopefully Synology will come back saying that DSM 5.0 is immune from the bug. And if that's the case, then just like it was with the Dogecoin hack, it comes back to people, you need to keep your devices up to date. Let's move on to the next story, and that is, it's going to be a bit contentious, but everyone keep an open mind, take a deep cleansing breath, because we're going to talk about Snowden for a bit. For nearly a year now, the United States government officials have said that the revelations from former NSA contract worker Edward Snowden have harmed national security and allowed terrorists to develop their own countermeasures. Well, we've mostly been skeptical of those claims, especially since these same officials haven't really offered us any believable proof that those revelations have harmed national security beyond egg on their faces. However, now an independent tech firm in Cambridge, Massachusetts, says it has used big data analysis of tangible data within the communication patterns of terrorist cells to quantify and qualify the damage to national security. The firm Recorded Future is releasing a report that comes to the conclusion that the Snowden documents forced Al-Qaeda to dramatically change the way that it communicates online. The company brought in cyber expert Mario Vuskan, the CEO of Reversing Labs, to investigate the technical aspects of the new software being used. Vuskan essentially reverse engineered the 2013 encryption updates that Al-Qaeda used and found not only more sophisticated software, but also newly available downloads that have found encryption on cell phones, Android products, and Macs. And as it turns out, as they look through their data, what they found that Al-Qaeda wasn't just tinkering, but that all of these changes happened within 4 months of the revelations, suggesting a causal change. Now, I want to throw this over to you first, Curtis. This is nice. It's nice to know that we can put a little bit of weight behind saying that, yeah, the revelations of what we've been doing in security have hurt our ability to surveil those who wish harm upon the United States. But this doesn't really change any of the ways that people are going to feel about Snowden, right?
Oh, I don't think it does. The people who support him will say that these are evolutionary changes that were probably underway anyway. And the most that happened was that they accelerated a little bit. Those who oppose Snowden and what he did will say that the opponents got a bit less stupid, that he was able to educate our enemies, and that causes direct harm. And I suspect that, as in so many cases, the truth lies somewhere between these. I mean, it is a fact that relatively few of the criminals out there, whether they're criminals with a political motivation or a commercial motivation, very few of them are actually criminal geniuses. They tend to be people who take advantage of opportunities. And so law enforcement of various sorts takes advantage of that, takes advantage of the weaknesses, the vulnerabilities, and frankly, the stupidity of many of these actors. When you educate them, it raises the floor. It increases the burden on law enforcement and anti-terrorist sorts. The question is, you know, how much did they change, and did they change faster than they were going to? Those are difficult questions to answer. I'm guessing the answer is somewhat. But whether this is a true game changer or not, I kind of doubt.
Yeah, now, Chiebert, I'm gonna play devil's advocate here for a second. There are those, of course, who are gonna be saying, "Well, see, we told you. We told you that this was bad. We told you that this was unpatriotic. We told you that this was gonna destroy American security." But at the same time, I'm not necessarily getting that read off the report. I mean, to say that Al-Qaeda has upgraded their security, that Al-Qaeda has changed the way they communicate, is essentially to say, well, they never would have if they didn't hear about this. They never would have changed their encryption techniques. They never would have updated their security protocols. Isn't this just, it's sort of a coincidence? It's like, yeah, okay, they found out that the United States was trying to listen in on their conversations, but they knew that before. Is it kind of specious to say that this caused Al-Qaeda to upgrade their capabilities?
No, it's kind of like saying, you know, when Phil Zimmerman introduced Z Phone, God knows how long ago, that was going to be the end of the world because now you can encrypt your corporate communications. No, it's just yet another set of tools. You know, that whole argument about guns don't kill people, people kill people. Well, I'm sorry, you know, the guys at the NSA are going to have to work harder to crack the communications. We're going to have to work smarter. But the tools have been there, and we could not have expected them to stay dumb for forever. At least we're having some sort of known quantities. We at least know it's happening. We're going to have to work harder. So, no, I think it would have happened anyway. It's just a matter of Mr. Snowden just turned on the flashlight.
There's something else to consider here, and that is whether or not this should be something that Enterprise should take to heart. I mean, for the last year or so, we've all had issues about whether or not our data is flowing securely, flowing freely. But in this report, we could take it the other way and say, well, should we now be using the same encryption that Al-Qaeda is using? Should we now be using ZPhone now that we know that that's a headache for the NSA? Should we now all be encrypting all of our traffic to make it almost impossible for you to pick an encrypted needle out of an encrypted haystack? What about that, Curtis? I think the question that Cheever wanted to pose was, was this Snowden actually raising the level of encryption, or is this just all of us becoming aware that we need to get more encrypted with our data?
I think, again, there's a little bit of both. Is the overall awareness of encryption going up? Absolutely. You know, over the past 12 months, I've heard a lot more people talk about encrypting their data at rest. We've had a long time awareness that you needed to encrypt the transactions that were going on, encrypt your data as it's moving from place to place. But I've had a lot more conversations with people who were doing whole disk encryption, who were encrypting critical files, who were looking at encrypting portions of NAS arrays. That wasn't happening 3 or 4 years ago. So there has been a dramatically increased rate of awareness about how important it is to encrypt your data if you want to keep it secure. And as we were saying, just like in every other thing, even if they're not leading the commercial world, the criminals are aware of the commercial world. They see what they're up against. They decide they're going to employ the same sort of tactics. It is an arms race. And everyone in the industry knows that it's an arms race. One side will have the lead for a while, then the other. Mr. Snowden changed the balance perhaps a little bit for a short period of time, but I think that it's no more than a few months shift in the balance, if that.
I think we should just all act as if we are sitting in Vegas for Black Hat and DEF CON and just encrypt everything. Let's move on to the next story. This comes from CNN Money. Your car is a giant computer, and it can be hacked. Now, the reason why we bring this up, even though it sounds like a consumer story, is that especially when we start talking about the Internet of Things, when we start talking about everything connected to everything, these sort of hacks are going to become more prevalent. Imagine driving down the highway at 70 miles per hour when suddenly your wheel turns hard right. You crash, and it was because someone had hacked your car. This would have been impossible a couple of years ago, but now with all cars having computers and hydraulic / computer-assisted turns and brakes, well, it's not just possible, it's kind of easy. Interviews with automaker suppliers and security advisors reveal major problems with the new wave of connected cars. The inside of your car has ancient technology that presents a security risk, and unfortunately, when connected with the technology that actually controls your car, it means that, yeah, that hacks. The 50 to 100 tiny computers that control your steering, acceleration, and brakes are really, really dumb. They rarely conduct authentication checks or check whether that message is really coming from you. In other words, it would be like running your computer on the internet with no username, no password, and a big sign that said, "Hack me." The computer code in car is outdated. It's similar to the on-off switches used in industrial controls, which means that it's easily manipulated. And they also found out that much like the human central nervous system, every electronic part inside of a car is connected to a central spine. You tap one part and you can reach all the others. Now, Chibert, let me just start with a question, a silly question here. Are we going to have to start running antiviruses on our cars?
Well, I certainly saw that in a couple of science fiction movies or books and so forth. Yeah, it's very much like what's happening with SCADA. You know, we can't stay dumb forever. If you got onto a physical SCADA control system in the past, you could go and wreak havoc. Air gaps aren't going to work forever. And when your network is moving and going into public places and might be sitting in a garage for a while, what's to keep someone from putting something, say, as simple as an Arduino or a Raspberry Pi onto that control network and provide a gateway into a cell phone or Bluetooth or something like that? It's just too easy, and I'm sorry. This is more of my call to arms. So this is the Cheebert rant. What we really need to do is we have to have curriculum where electrical engineers and computer scientists work together engineers don't write good software. Software people don't know how to deal with hardware. This is a really good illustration that we have become overly specialized, and we need some people that know about both systems so we can have secure automation in our automobiles in the near future.
Right. Curtis, let me throw this over to you, because this is just a symptom of connecting to the internet things that were never designed to be connected to the internet. Or actually, go one step down. Connecting to a network, things that were never supposed to be connected to a network. It brings to mind a project that I was working on for KnowHow that I abandoned. I got my hands on one of the new Mercedes that have the driving assist that keep you from wandering from lane to lane, that keep you from running into cars at speed. Very cool technology, but the computer was completely accessible. It was not defended. All you needed was a physical connection, even if that physical connection came in the form of wireless that you plugged into the onboard data port. And you could control the anti-collision system. So you could essentially tell the car to turn right or left by fooling it to think that its sensors are detecting something in front of it. This is, again, the law of unintended consequences, is it not? The fact that we think everything is better connected, but we don't consider what the connected things might be connected to.
Yeah, I think in one sense, we should all be grateful that there are still corners of the world, whether it be Tsukuba in Japan or Detroit in the U.S., where everyone is trustworthy and happy, and no one would ever think of doing something wrong with unlimited access to a physical system. That's obviously the world that many of these engineers live in, and I'm happy for them. For the rest of us, this does create some issues. And the thing is, it creates issues not only for the future. I mean, a lot of people have gone off and said, well, what happens with self-driving cars and all that? But as you point out, this is a very real issue for cars that we're driving around today. And all we have to do is look at what General Motors is currently going through regarding their reluctance to change out a simple physical ignition switch to understand just how enormous the headache might be if there's a major software vulnerability that becomes exploited. I'm not sure that our current recall system is set up to deal with something like that. They're set up to deal with physical problems that can be dealt with in an ongoing basis. The idea of something as time-critical as a zero-day exploit is as foreign to the automotive industry as, I don't know, putting a propeller and rudder on the back of their cars. It's a major cultural shift, and one that they're going to have to make very, very quickly unless they're willing to open themselves up to simply enormous liability.
Moki in the chat room actually has a truly devastating, terrifying, horrifying thought, and that is combine these sorts of hacks with the ransomware hacks, and suddenly you get a text message saying, give me your credit card number and I'll let you out of your car. This one's closer to home. We have got Scott Michaud who's saying, isn't that the whole problem? He's talking about authentication, not authenticating. The problem with Windows, that's really the problem that we've been having in the enterprise the last two decades. This idea that, of course, everyone can have administrative rights because it's their machine. That's how we typically have designed things. And I'm very guilty of that. I'd like to have administrative access to everything I own, everything that's connected to my data, connected to my daily life. But that's really not the best way to do it. I mean, Chibert, let me throw this over to you. Even though we always want to be running administrator, or even though we always want all those privileges, even though we always want to avoid having to deal with authentication at every twist and turn, that's the best way to design hardware, even though it's a bigger pain in the butt. That means that if in the future, if we use these devices and software for purposes they were never designed for, they won't be as big of a security risk.
Yeah, but authentication isn't just username and password. It's also signatures. There really isn't any reason why those small computers, why SCADA can't have a trusted upstream, trusted downstream type of thing. Digital signatures are still very difficult to hack, especially if you're using dual key. And it the CPUs being what they are, it's not that much overhead. I think it's really more just, are hackers really the only ones that are security and hardware savvy? Our school system isn't teaching it. You know, shame on us. You know, the very fact is computer science students that I've managed to deal with really don't even learn about digital certificates until they're seniors. Oh my God, this should be taught in high school. We need to change the way our students are learning about these things because, I'm sorry, the guys that are designing cars right now went to school 20 or 30 years ago. They never had to deal with it. But the new kids that are coming in that are going to be designing this stuff do know how. GM, Ford, Chrysler, come on, guys. Listen to the new kids. They've learned a few good, hard lessons, and it's time for you to listen.
I think the bottom line here is I'm with Dale Poco. Damn those hackers. Now I know why my car keeps turning into McDonald's. Let's go on to the next story from the Business Insider. This is something that I think everyone probably has heard at least a little bit about. That is whether or not Google went too far when they reported child pornography to the authorities. A Houston man has been arrested after Google sent a tip to the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, saying the man had explicit images of a child in his email. Now, the man was a registered sex offender, convicted of sexually assaulting a child in 1994, and he was keeping the picture inside of his email account. Now, the authorities were saying that they can't see that information, but that Google could see the information, and they're the ones who tipped off the task force. Chibert, let me throw this over to you. This obviously has some serious security implications because we all know that Google can reach into our emails. We know that Google can reach into anything we do on Google, searching, anything in Hangouts, anything in email, anything on Google, on YouTube. All those services are there so that Google can gather data points on us to sell us ads. We've kind of become okay with that. But does this cross the line? Is this into the creepy zone where now they're actually looking at photos within my accounts and telling on me if those photos don't pass muster?
I personally don't mind. Sure, I like my privacy. Sure, what happens behind closed doors is supposed to stay private. But most of people will agree that child pornography, child abuse is something that needs to be exposed, needs to be stopped, we need to put these people away. We need to get them away from our children. There's a reason why police, and there's a reason why child abusers don't last long in prison. The world doesn't like it. So even though it bothered me when I first read this, just as I got to the point about a missing or exploited children, it's like, I'm going to bite my tongue because I would like these people to get put away. You know, it's one of those crimes that crosses so many boundaries that I don't think, I don't know, there may be a point where I say, no, that's too much, but having Google read the email to go, and they're actually not even reading the email. In this case, they're only looking for hash values that was given to them by the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children, and they're the hash values of known child pornography images, and they're only comparing the hashes. They're actually not reading your email. They're just looking for child pornography.
Yeah, we think we know a little bit about this technology. We think that it probably matched first on a Google has a really good image, automated image detection software algorithm that allows them to know if it's a person, if it's scenery, whatever it is. We also know that they have a flesh algorithm. So it could have been flagged first by the flesh algorithm, and then it could have been flagged by a database that's maintained of known pornographic images. The problem is we just don't know. I mean, Google doesn't want to tell us, and it's actually better that they not tell us because if the child pornographers actually knew how it worked, it would be really easy to circumvent. But then we get back to security through obscurity. I want to throw this over to you, Curtis, because Chibert brought something up that I think is very important in this case, and that is I want this guy to be caught. You know, I would like him and others like him, and I would like people who break the law and put the public at danger to be caught. But this sounds like such a ridiculously slippery slope, because in my mind, if they caught this guy, it means that there must be 1,000 people whose images they look through because it flagged something, but there was never a story made about that. I mean, that's the creepy part, right? I mean, when we start thinking, well, what are they doing with my data?
You're exactly right. And, you know, let me say, I'm a parent. Child pornography is abhorrent. There is no way to defend it or the people who traffic in it. With that said, we cannot constantly fall back to the argument that the end justifies whatever means. We've had this debate on terrorism and whether torture is justified. We've had this in regards to many invasions of privacy by the government. I mean, it's similar in some regards to the discussion we've had over looking through and keeping telephone metadata, and the fact that the government has gone even beyond that and gone into telephone conversations that by statute they were not supposed to. The government has learned that there are two or three keywords that it can throw up: terrorism, homeland security, child pornography, and expect that that will shut down any debate, shut down any discussion over whether the means that they use are appropriate. And sometime in their argument in that direction will come the phrase, if you're not doing anything wrong, you have nothing to fear. That is not an appropriate argument to make in a system with the basis that we claim is the basis for the United States. There are systems where that's a perfectly valid basis, but not the United States. I think this is beyond a slippery slope. Again, do I want this guy caught? Absolutely. Do I care how he is caught? Absolutely. And when we know that a private entity is looking in any way at the contents of every message and passing information on to the civil authorities, I think we have crossed the line at which it is an acceptable method to use, no matter how desirable the outcome.
Gentlemen, I want to continue this discussion, but unfortunately, we're kind of pushing up against the deadline here. So I will do this. We have a all TWIT crossover episode next week between This Week in Enterprise Tech and This Week in Law. The hosts are going to come together, and this, I want one of the stories to be this, because this goes beyond child pornography. This goes beyond law enforcement. There is something else here, and that is what we sign away when we sign EULAs, or what we sign away when we get employment at an agency. There was actually a comment in the chat room that was very good, saying the part that disturbed him the most was the fact that you had a law enforcement official saying, well, we couldn't do that. We couldn't reach into someone's email, but Google can. If Google gives us the image, then we can act. It seems to me as if we've shortcutted the Constitution when it comes to the enterprise, when it comes to what we expect out of our web services. If we can sign a EULA, or if we can sign a contract that now says I give up all my privacy rights when my data flows through a corporate network or through a cloud service, then I think we may need to take a look at how seriously we're looking at our constitutional rights. Now, when we come back, we're going to be talking all about Black Hat and DEF CON. We're going to bring up some of our favorite pre-show stories and maybe go over some geeking with you. But before that, I want to take a moment to thank the first sponsor of This Week in Enterprise Tech, and that's Prosper. Now, what would you do if I told you that in 72 hours you could have $35,000 to cover your needs? Well, what would you do with it? Would you consolidate your high-rate credit card debts? Would you start a business? Would you finally do that home improvement project that you've been putting off year after year? Well, what if I told you that by filling out an easy online application and providing a few details, you could see that rate online instantly without ever stepping foot in a bank? Well, that's not fantasy, folks. That's Prosper. Prosper offers low fixed rates, unsecured personal loans, and has multi-year terms available. I remember a long time ago when my computer consultation company grew past my resources. This was before I entered the priesthood. I needed cash. It was a successful business, but I needed to be able to continue my operations until I could collect on my contracts, which means, unfortunately, that I needed a loan from a bank. And that process was just as demeaning as it was confusing, showing one bank manager after another that my business wasn't just cash positive, but profit flush, with a need for just enough to fulfill my contracts. I wish Prospero had existed back then, because I could have saved myself the wear and tear of the bank shuffle and gotten the cash I needed immediately. Prospero is an innovative peer-to-peer lending process, Silicon Valley's answer to a more modern community-based personal loan. There are no outrageous fees, no raising interest rates, and yes, you'll never step foot in a bank. Prospero has more than 2 million members, lenders and borrowers alike, and over $1 billion in funded loans. This is the promise of peer-to-peer lending, connecting people who need money with those who have it to loan. Just go to prospero.com/twit and check your rate instantly without affecting your credit score. For a limited time, Prospero is offering Twit viewers a $50 Visa prepaid card when you get a loan. Go to prospero.com/twit. That's a special site just for our viewers. Up to $35,000 in just 3 days and a $50 Visa prepaid card. Go to prospero.com/twit. And we thank Prospero for their support of this week in Enterprise Tech. Now let's get right to it. We've got a couple of picks here. And my first pick is the Pony Express. I got an email from a friend over at Pony Express who wanted to share with me one of the exciting announcements that they're going to be making at Black Hat this year. Now, if you don't know Pony Express, they're known for making security assessment devices. They're very popular at DEF CON. It's basically a plug-and-play appliance that can do scanning, pen testing, sniffing, spoofing, pretty much anything you might want to do whenever you're doing a security assessment. Now at Black Hat and DEF CON, they'll be introducing a new enterprise class SaaS, SaaS, that's software as a service offering. So it's going to operate up in the cloud. The service will combine hardware sensors, security software, and a management platform that will allow you to do total remote location intelligence. Now, the idea is to be able to be in one location and be able to do all your pen testing, be able to do all your packet sniffing, be able to do all your security assessment from that location, which is great if you run multiple locations. Now, Brian, I believe you do have a link or two that you could be throwing up on the screen right now. Pony Express was just in the news last month when they used the Pony plug to spy on an NPR reporter. Now, I should note for all the people who think they're going to get one of these devices and spy on their neighbors that they arranged to spy on an NPR reporter. They wanted to demo it. What they did was a man-in-the-middle attack. They had the reporter associate with the AP that the Pony plug was broadcasting, and they passed the traffic through. And as they passed the traffic through, they were able to sniff the packets and pull clear text items, passwords, usernames, et cetera, et cetera. Now, the cool thing about the Pony plug is it uses all off-the-shelf hardware and software to sniff that packet stream. And this is the kind of technology that they're going to be bringing into their enterprise class offering. Now, Cheever, let me ask you first about this. I always get excited whenever we start talking about security appliances that are designed to break security, because most of the time I deal with firewalls and IDS, IPS boxes that are supposed to keep intruders out. But whenever you have a box that is designed to bypass that, you kind of have to have the mind of a troll, the mind of a hacker, right?
Oh, yeah, totally. You know, this is the type of device that either is going to scare you or help you. You've got to be able to go and look at it from both sides of the river on this one. I have used these types of devices so that I can go and find out just how well I've secured my systems. The reality is there are, especially in things like VPNs and intrusion detection systems, ways to see what's happening with this type of attack. It's not always effective, and it's a very subtle way of doing things. But you have to have the tools to make sure that you've done it right. And so in my case, I've actually gone in and said, you know, how well does this protect me when my people are out in the field doing, say, SSL VPNs in? And using something like this, it actually brings up this man in the middle. It's very, very easy to get set up. But my SSL VPN actually goes and does some signatures and said, no, you don't match anymore, and we're going to shut this down. It's a great test tool, and you're never going to know how well you've done in your securing of your system unless you actually try it out. Take it for a test drive. Try and break it, or at least try and test it. You know, poke and prod at it a little bit. So I'm looking forward to talking to the guys at Pony Express and see if they'll loan me one.
All right. Curtis, we had Raphael Mudge on last week. And when we asked him about this, when we asked him about people who basically accused him of developing tools for black hats and for those who would exploit networks in order to take advantage of people, his response was basically, look, it's out there. These vulnerabilities are out there. Whether or not you want to admit, whether or not you see them, they're there. Tools like his tools actually help you to find the advanced persistent threats because you can run those tools on your own enterprise, on your own network. I think Pony Express is the same way. Because they're kind of associated with DEF CON, there are a lot of people who think that they're just in the hands of these nefarious teenagers who go out and hack their local high school. But there are actual decent security devices. These are great appliances to have, if for nothing else, to be able to do simple wiretapping whenever you need something on the quick. Would you say that this is these kinds of devices are something that every security professional, every IT professional, should not just be aware of, but should be seriously considering?
Oh, absolutely. As you say, what this does is it gives a relatively cheap and easy way to do quick security assessments. Now, is this going to replace a full-bore professional pen test? Well, no. But if you have suspicions, if you need to do a quick check, if you need to know whether it's worth commissioning a more substantial security review, say, off sequence, this could be an incredibly useful tool. And the argument that these are just tools for hackers, the same thing could be said for virtually every piece of both offensive and defensive security out there. We've been talking just recently about the encryption that terrorist organizations are using. They're using open source encryption tools. Does the fact that they can use them mean that no one should be able to use them? Of course not. It simply means that the tools are out there, the vulnerabilities are out there. It behooves everyone to be as prepared as possible, and a tool like this goes a long way toward making that possible.
Thank you, Curtis. On to you, Cheebert. You've got a pick for a booth that you want to hit at Black Hat.
Oh, yeah. Well, I've had a long, long relationship with Fluke Networks, and considering that story about the Massachusetts group that created glassware that can actually watch, actually not even watch, you can't even, in this case, you don't even need to see the screen. All it does is maps the shadows of your fingers to be able to steal passwords into iPads, iPhones, and so forth. Well, Fluke Networks is going to be announcing a new, I don't know, I guess you would call it an add-on feature set to their Air Magnet Enterprise system. And in this case, it allows you to go and track signatures for drones and Google Glass users. So it can identify it and then actively shut down the connectivity for these devices. So that if, say, for instance, you're a motor company and you're testing out a new car that's still under wraps at a test track, if someone's flying a drone over there, what are you going to do? Are you going to go and take out a shotgun and shoot it down? And, well, better yet, maybe you should go talk to Fluke Networks about getting an automated system so you can protect your facilities from the prying eyes of drones or from the prying eyes of someone wearing Google Glass. And maybe they probably forgot to turn it off when they came onto your property. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, let's go take a look at what the folks at Fluke Networks are doing. And, who knows? Maybe you'll find a nice match for what you're going to get ready to do.
Chibert, one of the things that struck me when I heard about that story is it sounds like they're not like doing a DDoS attack. I think they're actually just creating broad spectrum interference within the 2.4 and 5 gigahertz range to knock these devices off their respective networks. But if they do that, they run afoul of the FCC, right? You can't cause interference to knock off communications. I mean, if it happens just inadvertently because of the amount of energy running through the air, that's one thing. But if you have a device that's specifically targeting devices to knock them off a network, that I don't see how that becomes legal.
Actually, I don't think that's a problem because, remember, the 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz is the wild, wild west. It is unregulated. And you technically do own at least a little bit of the airspace considered as part of your property. So if you set a policy saying, no, I'm not going to allow this particular type of RF, I think comes into a very gray area. And I should also point out that air magnet has been around a long time, and it's not just the 2.4 and 5.8 gigahertz range. They have radios in lots of different ranges and will detect things other than Wi-Fi devices. When I first reviewed the air magnet system, probably back before 2000, it was also able to help me identify things like leaky microwave klystrons, sodium lights, and things like that. It helped me identify all kinds of things in the environment that would be detrimental to the Wi-Fi arena. So I'm saying, yeah, let's go and take a look at what Fluke Networks has. They're at the Black Hat booth number 1123.
All right, Curtis, what is your first pick for Black Hat?
My first pick for Black Hat is from Mokana. And what they're doing is dealing with some of the OpenSSL vulnerabilities. I'm still waiting on some details because while they're there, they will be announcing a drop-in open source replacement for, well, theirs is an open source, but theirs is a replacement for the open source SSL stack that most Apache web servers are using. We know that there are vulnerabilities for both SSL and TLS. They're providing a drop-in that will make those more secure, patch up some of the known vulnerabilities. And for all of the companies that are using SSL to encrypt the communications back and forth with customers, with partners, with employees out in the field, this could be an enormous thing. It's not real sexy. It's not glamorous. But boy, howdy, is it necessary.
Yeah, the non-sexy, non-glamorous stuff, that's the booths that you often just move past. You go, oh, okay, that's interesting. But they are often the ones that you're going to use most often. I want to go into my next pick. I've got Check Marks. It's a vulnerability code scanner. And I have to admit that the only reason why I picked this one is because I also run a show on the Twit Network called Coding 101. I find this fascinating. They developed a software suite that can scan uncompiled code for potential vulnerabilities and exploits. The way it works is that you load the code into the scanner. It targets individual pieces with a list of known vulnerabilities and theoretical best practices and regulatory compliance practices. Then it alerts you when that piece of code will be vulnerable to an exploit or if it's in violation of best practices or the regulatory compliance rules that you have for your particular business. Now, here's the cool part, because I've seen software that does that before. It doesn't just tell you where the weakness is. It actually identifies where the fix should go. Because if you've been programming, especially if you've been programming in a group, sometimes you can fix an exploit at a different spot, and it will sort of cascade down to other modules, which just makes for much better programming. This is something that we've been playing with for a while. This idea of making sure your code is least buggy as possible before you actually release it. It kind of fascinates me that they've created a product that seems to be pretty dang good. They're going to be both at Black Hat, and I believe they've got at least a person who's going to be showing up at DEF CON. So if I can, I'm going to go ahead and check out Check Marks. Now, Chibert, you've got a shout-out to a friend of the show.
Oh, we love Raphael Mudge, the ethical hacker. And he is actually going to be blipping back and forth between Black Hat and DEF CON this year. And I wasn't able to get a hold of him in time to find out what his booth numbers are. So, Raphael, I'm hoping you're in the chat room. But anyway, the ethical hacker and his Cobalt Strike it's been the foundation of a lot of red teams the whole concept of a cyber range is kind of like a shooting range. You want to be able to have a safe place to go and practice your art, because knowing the best attacks also gives you a great clue on how to secure your systems. So, Raphael, we love you, dude. You scare the pants off the chat room every time you're on. We love your product. I'm eating the learning curve as fast as possible. And I love the fact that Raphael has been instrumental in a lot of the cyber range activities all across the nation. And thank you so much for the support from my students when we built the cyber range last year in Honolulu. And look forward to seeing you at DEF CON in Black Hat, dude.
Go Red Team. Curtis, you've got a second pick.
That I do. You know, while there are a lot of products that are introduced at Black Hat, there are also a lot of announcements about vulnerabilities that have been found. That's a big part of what the conference is about. But companies release announcements of vulnerabilities too. We have a company called Anapsys Research Labs. And they have released 6 critical security advisories for companies using SAP's HANA architecture. Now, if you're not living in the big enterprise ERP space, HANA is SAP's in-memory computing architecture. Basically, what they do is take a large piece of their huge corporate database, suck it into RAM, and run queries on it. They're able to do complex analysis at lightning speeds on intensely expensive pieces of hardware. I've seen some of these, and we're talking about hardware with upwards of 32 to even 64 terabytes of RAM. And what Anapsys has done is found some new vulnerabilities, including things like cross-site scripting vulnerabilities in the HANA administration tool, authentication bypass, missing encryption, verb tampering issues, missing authorization checks. None of these are vulnerabilities where they say you should immediately stop using HANA, but they all point to the fact that this is a technology that has come onto the market and evolved very rapidly. And we've seen many, many times that rapidly evolving software can have vulnerabilities. In this case, it can simply be vulnerabilities in significant enterprise, largest, and most critical databases.
Thank you. Indeed, indeed. Now, my last pick, I was searching through all the Black Hat emails that I've received over the last month or so, and this one struck my eye because it's not network protection. I mean, it is, but in a different way. Now, most of our security efforts are focused on stopping network or email fraudsters, but there aren't that many that can do the same thing for phone scamming. It's not as simple as hanging up on a telemarketer, especially if you're running a larger enterprise. As anyone at Black Hat or DEF CON can attest to, it's often the human resource that fails the security audit. And one of the ways that they're not used to being pen tested is through the phone. It's way easier to social engineer yourself into access that you shouldn't have. And the phone is a big part of that. Well, there's a company called Pindrop that is trying to change all that. They say that they stop fraudsters and telemarketers before they stop. Now, here's the idea. It integrates into your existing call center or VoIP setup to capture fraudulent calls before they get to your users. They use a variety of methods. The first is threat intelligence. So they keep a database, in fact, the largest database of quote-unquote bad actor phone numbers. But that only helps if the bad actors are being honest about what number they're coming from. They often try to spoof. So they also use what's called audio intelligence. And this is the part that I love. They look for acoustic signatures within the call itself to detect if an automated system is being used to bypass your phone trees, as well as any robo-dialers that might be looking for live people that then hand off calls to live fraudsters. So you can't fake the audio signature. Your audio signature is going to be the same as long as you're using the same pieces of hardware. They also do auto verification of callers to make sure that the call isn't being forwarded through a spoofing system, which is a big plus. And finally, they have a worldwide network. And this is interesting. They use big data analytics along with all the data points they get from that worldwide network to determine when the next surge of fraudsters are going to come through. You may not know this about fraud calls, but they tend to happen in waves. Because when they do a campaign, they typically try to hit as many people as fast as possible, and then they pack up and they move their tents. Well, what this can do is it can detect all the early signals of people testing the vulnerabilities of call centers, people testing the vulnerabilities of relays, and they've used that to be able to say, we think there's going to be a big attack within 16 days, so in 15 days, we're going to batten down the hatches and increase the level of security, increase the level of scrutiny on our regular security metrics. It's a fantastic system. I actually want to see it in action. So I'm going to be checking out PinDrop. Cheever, sir.
Yeah, I'm going to talk about yet more old friends. I've watched Splunk grow up from when it was only a couple dozen people. And, you know, it's been one of these, you know, stealth things. It's they haven't been the flashiest. They haven't been the loudest. But they got the best T-shirts. I mean, take the SH out of T. Oh, come on. That is totally a classic. But if you're thinking it's only for syslogs, you're wrong. The Splunk system has generations beyond just syslog. In fact, at University of Hawaii, we're now starting to use it so we can index power monitoring data because Splunk is able to take any time series data and index it. Think of it as kind of like Google indexing for syslog. But no, it's time series, and you can do more things. But by having a lot of data that's flowing into the Splunk server, you can do some really, really interesting things for security because you want to be able to correlate things together. So maybe some events, I don't know, say you're trying to find out maybe there's too many card key scans coming, or maybe there's a Wi-Fi happening at the same time someone's doing a foreign country VPN login. That's kind of bad. I don't know. I'm going to go to the Splunk booth and find out what they have in mind because they're going to be announcing, our Spelunkers are going to be showing some great new tools for the Splunk Enterprise platform that is targeted specifically at the security experts. So I'm going to go and get my free T-shirt. Thank you, Michael Wild, at the Black Hat booth in Mandalay Bay, booth number 459. Look forward to seeing you there.
Gentlemen, thank you very much. I think we've given our audience a nice little preview of some of the booths that we're going to be hitting. Now, I have no idea what we're going to be seeing at Black Hat and DEF CON this year. And that's got me a little bit excited. Normally, you see the same vendors over and over again. But looking at the vendor list this year, I think we're going to be able to come back from the show with plenty of interesting video. I want to thank my host because unfortunately we have reached the end of another hour of This Week in Enterprise Tech. That's right. You've listened to the best dang enterprise class podcast in the world. That's according to 9 out of 10 remote exploits. I want to thank my host for coming on and being with me here today, starting with Mr. Brian Chi, the man with awful voice sync, thanks to the way I set up Skype. Brian, can you tell the folks where they can find you?
Well, hopefully they won't find me on Cox for too much longer because, boy, this internet connection, bleep. Anyway, thanks a lot. Look for me at DEF CON and Black Hat. I look forward to wandering around and seeing what kind of really cool things there are and making my network safer.
Absolutely. And, of course, my good friend, Mr. Curtis Franklin, who we will see you tomorrow. And I wanted to bring you to Crab, but I've been informed that if Brian eats Crab, he will blow up like a balloon. So we'll have to find something else. Can you tell the folks where they'll find you when you're not at DEF CON and Black Hat?
Well, when I'm not at Black Hat and DEF CON, I'm going to be on the radio. And actually, while I'm at Black Hat, I'm going to be on the radio Wednesday and Thursday. We've got two live shows each day from Black Hat. Those are going to be over at darkreading.com. If you can't make it to Las Vegas, come on over to Dark Reading. Catch the live shows. There's going to be one in the afternoon, one in the evening, East Coast time. Late morning and late afternoon, West Coast time. Please join us. We'd love to have you asking questions, making comments on what our guests and the editors are saying. It's going to be a lot of fun. Then next week, hey, right back to the swamp.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you, of course, for joining. It's always a pleasure to talk to the both of you. And also, it's a pleasure to talk to you. That's right, our loyal watcher, our loyal listener, the person who downloads every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech each week. We wouldn't have a show without you, and so we want to thank you by giving you an easier way to get all the episodes of Twiat for your enterprise goodness. Just go to our show page at twit.tv/Twiat. There you'll find a drop-down menu where you can select a RSS feed to automatically get the audio version into your iPhone so you can listen to us on your drive. Or maybe the regular definition video for your tablet, or maybe the high-definition video for your PC or your notebook so you can watch us in all our high-def glory on your big-screen TV. It's just one of the things that we do because, well, we love you. Also, why not follow us on Twitter? You can find me at twitter.com/PadreSJ. That's at PadreSJ. If you follow me, you'll find out what we're going to be doing for every episode of This Week in Enterprise Tech. And you'll also find out what else I'm doing on the Twit TV network. That includes the Twiat on 2:30s Mondays. On Thursdays, you're going to find me and Brian Burnett for Know How. That's at 11 o'clock, as well as Coding 101. That's at 1:30. Oh, and by the way, I'm adding a new show, Padres Corner, which will be Tuesdays, 7:30 p.m. Come join us. It will be a fun time for all. Also, did you know that we do this show live? That's right. Every Monday at 2:30, you're going to find us at live.twit.tv. If you join us early and stay late, you'll see the pre-show, the post-show, and all the little foibles and bloopers that get taken out of the final cut. Just go ahead and join us. And as long as you're here, jump into the chat room at irc.twit.tv and be entertained by some of the brightest engineers, some of the funniest trolls, and just some of the coolest people to call themselves part of the Twit Army. Finally, I want to thank everyone who made this show possible. Of course, to my co-host, to Lisa and Leo, but especially to my TD stand-in today, Mr. Brian Burnett. Brian, I don't know if you've got a camera turned on yourself, but if you do, could you tell the folks where they can find you on the Twit TV network?
They can find me in the darkness at Twit. No, you can find me at cranky_hippo on Twitter. And like Padre said earlier, Know How on Thursdays, where we do some crazy projects. I've been enjoying that lunchbox project we've been doing.
What lunchbox?
You know, where you bring your lunchbox to work and then I eat all the food.
Oh, yes.
In it.
No, I'm down with that.
No, the Thank RC you, Brian. Car lunchbox, Padre.
That thing. Yes, please. Yeah, especially join us on Know How. That show is a lot of fun. But until next time, I'm Father Robert Ballester, just reminding you that if you want to know what's going on in the Enterprise, just keep Twiat.